Good morning. I'm Nilgün Tolek, Director of Whistleblower Reprisal Investigations here at DOD-OIG. It's my privilege to introduce our next speaker, a combat veteran from St. Albans, West Virginia. Among the numerous positions she held during her 35-year service with the West Virginia National Guard were Detachment Commander, 1st Battalion, 77th Troop Command, Commander, 1257th Transportation Company, and Battalion Commander, 151st Military Police Battalion. She participated in combat operations in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and was responsible for the base closure of Camp Al-Takaidim, Iraq, the largest logistical base in Anbar province. And she was also responsible for the deployment of military police training teams throughout Anbar province to provide training to the Iraqi police force. She received many military awards and decorations, including the Bronze Star. And then she had to summon the courage to blow the whistle on a crime. I personally want to thank her for seeing the entire process through. Please welcome Lieutenant Colonel retired Teresa James.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I'm going to choose to be out here and to walk around as opposed to standing behind a podium. I've did both things, obviously, in my career. And what you're going to hear from me today is my personal story. So, first of all, let me thank you for having me. I appreciate it, and it means a lot to me. If somebody would have told me 6 years ago I would be standing on this stage and speaking as a whistleblower, I would have probably looked at them and said, yeah, when pigs fly, right? being down at the lower level where the rubber meets the road, being a whistleblower has a stigma attached to it. I mean, it truly does. You're labeled a troublemaker, a snitch, not a team player. So it's certainly not something that is pleasant to carry as a label. And I say all that to applaud what is going on here today. And you know, I'm at the highest echelon of the military hierarchy, the Department of Defense, who acknowledges and recognizes the importance of having people who can report misconduct and report wrongdoing. I can assure you that there are not many agencies today or on the 30th or between now and the 30th that are going to celebrate National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. I didn't even know it existed. So, you know, this is something that has to get trickled down to, you know, our lowest levels of our agencies so that it is acceptable and people don't fear and they're not afraid to report misconduct, waste, fraud, and abuse, to know that their report will be taken seriously and they'll be recognized for their actions. Another thing, as a result of this morning, listen to this, is in our last presentation was, you know, we got hotline personnel out here. And I think that it is important for, and having spoke with many a hotline throughout my experience. You can rest assured that you're not the first phone call, and I'm sure you know that. You might be the 10th phone call. And in addition to the stress, there's frustration, there's anger, there's bitterness, and people are just looking for that person on the other end of the phone who's going to help them and is going to listen to them and take their problems seriously. And trust me, I mean, I spoke with many, I got referred to many a different hotline, and ultimately got referred back to the original hotline. So I say all that for you out there in the audience that do work for a hotline, that, you know, there is a lot of stress and frustration that is associated with that person on the other end of that call. So let me get to my story. My, and I wanted to say those things before I forgot them. My story began in December of 2006. And I was sexually assaulted by a superior officer. It was at a TDY in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was at Camp Joseph Robinson in Little Rock, Arkansas. The assault occurred in Little Rock in a hotel. And I'm not going to get into the details of that. But after that, I went home, changed my flight so I could get home early. I just wanted to be away from my perpetrator, who was a superior officer. And I blamed myself. I was ashamed, and I blamed myself. And at the time, my career was thriving. I was a major. I had held all the operational cool assignments that I needed to, you know, get promoted with. So I came back home, and I didn't tell a soul. I kept that secret to myself. I tucked it away. I was a very resilient leader. I was confident, and just thought, I can deal with this myself on my own. And that's exactly what I did for 6 years. Let's fast forward to 2009. In January 2009, I reported another superior officer who was sexually harassing a subordinate. And he was my immediate supervisor. He was a Colonel 06. And that issue was passed over to the leadership. It was never investigated. Nothing ever happened. 6 months later, I was leaving for deployment. So you can rest assured, the January 2009 incident was not at the forefront of my mind at that time. So I deployed to the Anbar province of Iraq. Had my mission there. In July of 2010, it was right before I was coming back to, our unit was getting ready to redeploy. I sent my chief of staff at the time, who was also my perpetrator, who had sexually assaulted me, an email. And I was forced, obviously, to have to communicate with this person because he was in my chain of command. He was the chief of staff, and I had to work for him. So I sent him an email. We were on our way back, had to update him. And in that same email, I asked him, what's my assignment going to be when I return? And I had been selected for a promotion to lieutenant colonel by a promotion board, and I asked if I was going to be placed in a lieutenant colonel slot when I returned and be promoted. His response was, there are no plans to reassign you. There's no plans to promote you. We'll discuss that over beers. That was the response. I knew what that meant. And I was not going to subject myself to that type of behavior ever again. I already knew that and decided that. So what that meant was, I'm not getting promoted. I have no idea where I'm going to be when I return. And I'm just going to come back, and I'm just going to have to be quiet if I ever think that I'll ever get promoted again. I got back to the state of West Virginia, did some terminal leave after my deployment, and went back into my work environment in September of 2010. And this is the only analogy I know to use to give a big picture of what that environment looked like. I always said I left the combat zone and came into a firefight, and the firefight was in my in my own backyard in my own state with the people who I should be able to respect and trust. While I was gone, my perpetrator, who had assaulted me, and again, at this point, I still have not reported my assault, was sexually harassing other women. And the only thing that I could think of was, oh my God, he is going to do the same thing to them that he did to me. So this was in September of 2010. By December of 2010, the work environment was so bad that one of my subordinates would not even walk to the restroom without an escort because she was afraid that she would run into him in the hallway and didn't know how she could deal with it. There was fear. There was, the morale was very low. People were afraid of him, and women in particular were afraid of him. I, at the time, was one of the highest-ranking female officers there. These women came to me, and I had a duty, and they talked about that this morning, a duty and an obligation to do the right thing, and that was to report this guy for what he was doing to the other women within our complex. So I talked to the adjutant general, and in the National Guard, and I'll talk about the National Guard versus the active duty, but the highest person in the National Guard at the state level is the adjutant general. And that's who I made my appointment with, and that's who I went and seen, and I reported these criminal offenses to, because it's a crime. He did the right thing. He initiated an investigation into the allegations. And in January of 2011, the investigation came back where the allegations of sexual harassment were sustained. But in addition to that, and that was by seven women, in addition to that, there was physical assault, hostile working environment, failure to submit to a random urinalysis, gender epithets, disparate treatment, and the list goes on. And understand, I can only give you a very small sampling of the last 6 years, but I think you get the idea. This person was not a good person, and it affected so much of what was going on day to day in that complex and in that office. So this is January 11th, comes back. Those of us who were involved in it, it was, the expectation was that it was business as usual. We were called into a routine staff meeting one day, and we were told that my perpetrator, the harasser, was going to be gone for an unspecified amount of time due to medical reasons. We know otherwise because we know exactly what happened. So, again, the expectation was that we were supposed to go back to business as usual. And it wasn't anything other than, I mean, business as usual. So you couldn't talk about it. It, once again, you know, you had to keep those feelings, those emotions, and those things to yourself. Couldn't mention anybody's name. It was like the white elephant in the room. It's like nothing ever happened. So this goes on for a year. We never knew the results of the investigation. Those who were affected by the sexual harassment never knew it. A year later, in June of 2012, now keep in mind, the perpetrator and harasser is at home. Still on the payroll, still receiving a salary, still on the unit manning roster, and everybody knows this. West Virginia is a very small state. There are no secrets there. My subordinate, who had been sexually harassed, did a Freedom of Information Act request and obtained a copy of the investigation that was conducted in January 2011. She shared that with me. When she shared that with me, that was when I learned that I was not the only victim of sexual assault. That was when, for the longest time, I could never understand how somebody could have read that investigation and not took it to a different level. It was criminal. And that's when I felt that sense of duty to report my assault. So my initial report of assault was in August of 2012. And things at that point began to spiral out of control for me. I felt that's when my mental health started breaking down. It was, you know, I felt very guilty. For what happened to the other women. And I felt like, you know, I could have done something and should have done something. And I lived with, you know, that guilt and that selfishness for my own personal, because again, remember, I said I was thriving. My career was, I was, you know, on my way to bigger and better things. So, after my report in August of 2012, like I said, my mental health began to deteriorate. I took convalescent leave. And in November of 2012 was when I got my first reprisal, act of reprisal. In November of 2012, I received a referred officer evaluation report. It was a bad report. I've never had one in my life after 35 years of service. So I tried to interact with my raider and my senior raider, and I couldn't get, you know, any clear definition of why I was receiving this bad report. At the same time, and a lot of these things are moving simultaneously, there's reporting to law enforcement. There's reporting to CID. There's reporting. I actually reported to the Arkansas Police Department, and I actually reported to the Army CID. Of those two agencies, the Army CID did not have jurisdiction over my case because I was a Title 32 AGR soldier in the state of West Virginia. And Arkansas, who did have jurisdiction, had a statute of limitations of 6 years. You recall my assault occurred in December of 2006. It's now December of 2012. So there was a lack of time to get enough information to properly prosecute the case. Therefore, the prosecutor in Arkansas did decline to prosecute the case because of that, which left only one person. There's only one person left that can give me some justice for what happened to me and the other women in the organization, and that was the Adjutant General of the West Virginia National Guard. He did have the authority to charge and prosecute under the West Virginia Code. He chose not to. I'll get back to, you know, the reprisal piece. And my point with this is all of these things are going on simultaneously with the retaliation. So in January of 2013, I found out there was an administrative investigation into my sexual assault, since it was not prosecuted by law enforcement authorities. There was a team that came in from National Guard Bureau, and they substantiated my claim of sexual assault. The report came back in January 2013. On March the 5th of 2013, I was called into General Hoyer's office, who is the Adjutant General for West Virginia. And he was going to go over the findings of the investigation for the sexual assault, which he did. And he told me that my allegations were sustained. At the same time, he handed me a letter signed by him that I would be going to a medical review board. Now, this was in the very same meeting. Keep in mind, I'm learning for the first time my sexual assault has been substantiated. And then over here, oh, by the way, we're going to send you to a medical review board. And having been a commander, you know, I can understand that. And I did have some medical issues, and I didn't have any problem going to, you know, a medical review board. What I had the problem with was when I went and I seen a physician at Walter Reed National Medical Center, and he issued me a temporary profile, returned me, said I was fit for duty. It was what happened after that was a phone call to my doc while I was on leave in Italy, which prompted a change to my physical profile, and that's what prompted the medical evaluation board. So there were, those were the first two things, acts of reprisal, that I was aware of. The other act, I did not get an award. I was submitted for an award, which I did not receive. And I was reassigned several times. There's so many things that became a part of my complaint. In April of 2013 is when I said, enough is enough. This is, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. All I did was report wrongdoing, and now all of these happened to me, and I'm being, you know, hurt, and my career is being destroyed, and I'm sitting here watching it tumble right before my very eyes. So that's when I went online to the DOD hotline, and I submitted my complaint. And I got my call from the investigator, and he had talked to me about doing a telephonic interview because I was in West Virginia and they were in D.C. And at this point, you know, I had found that the telephone interviews didn't work for me. I wanted people to be able to see me. I wanted them to see the emotion. I wanted them to see, you know, what I was going through. So I flew out here, and I did my interview. And it was a very emotional and trying time. I was, at that point, I was a very broken. I was overwhelmed. I was an emotional train wreck, for lack of a better terms. It was some very hard times. But what followed was, it became even more of a struggle. It's not enough to file your complaint. It's what happens afterwards. It's that burden of proof. It's that evidence that, you know, if you could have seen my office, if you could see my office even today, the volumes of documents and evidence, and keep in mind this was not the only complaint I was dealing with at the time. I had some other complaints that were going on very simultaneously with us and boards. Very overwhelming. It's very overwhelming for somebody who is dealing with the emotional things that I was dealing with at the time, the anxiety. And here's an analogy that I like to use for this is, it's like being in a training exercise. Who's been in training exercises? We probably all have. And you get an inject from the white cell. And that was what a day in the life of a whistleblower was for me. You know, I never knew on any given day when I was going to get that inject from my investigator, when that next question was going to come, what that was going to prompt, how many things I was going to have to go through, which file am I looking at today, which text message am I going to have to find, which email am I going to have to find. It's just so overwhelming. So overwhelming. And the average person, the average person, the average, and I speak from a military perspective, the average military soldier of sexual assault, statistically, is between the ages of 21 and 28, female. They don't have this. They may have text messages, but you know they don't have these resources. They don't have the same capabilities that I had. They don't have the experience of the system. So, April 2013. My complaint's filed. The investigation continues. But my retaliation didn't stop. I'm supposed to be protected, right? But it didn't. Wasn't as blatant, but it didn't stop either. There were, and I'm going to talk about the social aspect of it. Having served in the West Virginia National Guard for 35 years, over half of my lifetime, you can imagine that most of my friends were part of that organization. So, very small organization. I call them silent supporters. I have a lot of silent supporters. And still today. And I didn't understand that for the longest time. You know, how can you not speak up? How can you, you know, not do the right thing? And then I reflected. I did the same thing myself. So I understand it. I get it. But there is still a fear of reprisal for anybody who affiliates themselves with me. And let me tell you why. After I reported in April 2013, there's been at least two investigations within my state where my known friends have been investigated for allegedly giving me information, and that was after a media release, I think it was last year, with NBC4. And I'll never forget those things. I'll never forget those phone calls. Teresa, I'd love to help you. I would absolutely love to help you, but I fear for my job. Nobody should ever, ever have to fear for their job, for helping somebody else or supporting somebody else. And if I had a dollar for every time somebody told me that, I'd be a rich person right now. So, fast forward to Now again, my health is still not where it should be. And I decided that the only way that I was going to have peace in my life was to leave the state of West Virginia. And that's what I did. I'm sorry. But literally, the only way that I was going to be able to have any sense of normalcy after this whole experience, I had to leave I had to leave my home state, my family, my friends, and I relocated. And it's been a good move, trust me. I was afraid in West Virginia. I never knew when I was going to run into somebody. I never knew when I would run into the people who had did these things to me, who had reprised against me, who had harassed me, who had assaulted me. And I couldn't live my life. It was isolated. I was isolated. I was avoided. I would pay my children to go to the grocery store. I mean, that's the kind of trauma and emotions that a person is dealing with. So in April 2014, I relocated to Central Florida at the advice of my counselor. And I've started a semi-new life. My case was substantiated in April of this year. But it's not over. It's not over. And I applaud your office, your agency for, you know, everything that they have done for me. But it's not over for me. It's not enough that, you know, I have a case that has been substantiated. Now, you know, I have to take that case, and it goes to the Secretary of the Army, and I have to file a package through the Army Board of Corrections just to get relief. Just to get relief. And throughout this process, I've actually hired two civilian attorneys, retained them. I've spent $10,000 to do that. $5,000 for the first one, $5,000 for the second one. And again, I say that, and I don't have it, trust me, I don't have the money. I'm retired now. But it's important, and it's important to me. But, you know, again, and the reason why I'm here, and the reason why I do this, and the reason why I testified at the joint proceedings panel, and the reason why I'm speaking out is not about me. It's about those people who don't have a voice, who are coming up in the ranks down there where the rubber meets the road, and I'll be their voice. I really will, if I have to be. And that's what inspires me today. That's what keeps me moving. That's what keeps me going. So I don't know how long I've spoke. But I think. Thank you.